And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today, and a big full show for us today. It's going to be a lot of fun. We'll be talking to folks from Oklahoma. They'll be here talking about that show that's coming up opening November 9th. Also, Alaska State Museum Jackie Manning will be here talking about a Coastal Impressions exhibit from NOAA. The Aware Capital Campaign, we'll be talking to folks about that. And also First Friday at the Franklin Street Gallery, Elise Thomason and Pau Manu will be talking to us about that. Plus, Nancy DeCherney will join us for Arts Up. It's all ahead in a Juno afternoon where we have mostly cloudy skies for the rest of today. Highs around 38 degrees, increasing clouds tonight, and rain in the forecast for tomorrow. Coming up next, National Native News.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A proposed bill in Wyoming would expand tribal law enforcement's jurisdiction to include traffic violations by non-tribal members on the reservation. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov reports.
On the Wind River Indian Reservation, Bureau of Indian Affairs law enforcement and Wind River police officers do not have authority over non-tribal members. That means if a tribal member and a non-tribal member are stopped for speeding, the Indian gets a ticket and the non-Indian is let go. Tribal Highway Safety Division officer Lieutenant Gilbert Peck says that's unfair.
And if we find three kids bouncing around on the seat with no child restraint, we don't have jurisdiction. So we have to just actually please buckle your children up, advise them of the law, drive safely, have a nice day, and you have to do it with a smile on your face. And it stings a lot having to do that, have to walk away from a crime just because of a person's affiliation with a tribe or skin color.
Peck says up to half of all traffic stops on Wind River involve non-tribal offenders. He says state troopers are called in for drunk driving cases, but they can take hours to arrive. The proposed bill would give BIA officers and the Wind River Police Department the power to issue citations to non-Indians themselves. Similar bills have been proposed in the past, but it's the first time one has passed a joint judiciary committee. It will be voted on in January's legislative session. For National Native News, I'm Irina Zhorov.
Today is the first National Bison Day. Several groups have come together to honor the buffalo the first Thursday in November. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt has more.
National Bison Day is the brainchild of the National Bison Association, the Wildlife Conservation Society, and the Intertribal Buffalo Council. They've started an annual celebration to honor one of the most significant symbols of the Great Plains and Western states. Bison had been nearly hunted to extinction in the last century, but have been making a comeback. The groups hope to gather congressional support to have bison named the national mammal. That designation wouldn't give the animals any more protection. It would serve mostly as an honor. Legislators from South Dakota, North Dakota, Wyoming, Colorado, Nebraska, Kansas, New Mexico, and Rhode Island have shown support for the idea. Events commemorating National Bison Day are being held in Washington, D.C., New York, Rapid City, South Dakota, and several other locations today. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbold.
A symposium of the romantic, if not always authentic, Old West world of German author Karl May was recently held in Cleveland, Ohio. WCPN's Brian Bull has more.
Born in 1842, May wrote fanciful works of cowboys and Indians, which collectively sold 200 million copies. He was one of the most beloved writers of all time among Germans. His fans include Adolf Hitler and Albert Einstein. Susanna Faiskolani is co-director of Case Western Reserve's German Studies program and a presenter at the symposium. She says May's work especially inspired East Germans during the Cold War, who went to great lengths to create detailed versions of Native American clothes, tools, and even villages complete with teepees based on May's descriptions.
Knowing communism, you know how hard it is to actually get any materials. This was a huge endeavor. They were trying to hunt down instructions on how to make the clothing, and they lived as Native Americans.
Movies were also made, though Apache Chief Winnetou was played by a Frenchman, while the scenes were shot in Croatia. But the dialogue was certainly Hollywood Western.
The white men have slain our brother, Black Eagle. They built tracks for their iron horse on our land without asking us. They have been destroying all our buffalo,
Mai himself never set foot in the Old West, only making it as far as Chicago before he died in 1912. But Faith Scolani says Mai's writing endures because of the epic landscapes he painted with words. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Cleveland.
During this week in 1968, the U.S. Post Office issued a 6-cent stamp of Nez Perce leader Chief Joseph. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain, and the waving wheat can sure smell sweet on, when the wind comes right behind the rain.
Let's hear it. Take it in. Go.
Oklahoma every night.
Honey Lemon and I sit alone and talk and watch a hawk making lazy circles in the sky.
Well, that's an advertisement for Oklahoma right there, if I ever heard
we
one.
We should have warmed up.
Hey, we've got Perseverance Theater in the Hizay here talking about Oklahoma. It's opening up November 9th, and we have Leo Grinberg in with us, Christina Apathy, and also Shona Strausser. And thanks you all
for coming in.
Shona, you're the director of the show coming
yes,
up, huh?
Yes, it's true.
So
it
this
is true.
Seems like a pretty big undertaking, I'm guessing, to direct Oklahoma. Big cast, a lot of stuff going on, right? A lot of moving parts.
Not really sure what I was thinking or what anybody was thinking. Why did they let me do
this?
Actually, we're in tech right now, so technical rehearsals where we add all the moving parts. So set-wise, lights and sound and bands and actors and costumes and, well, you know, everything. So far, so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It must be a challenge. Tell me some of the biggest challenges in directing, just, I guess, any huge musical, especially one so well-known.
Well, musically challenging, it's everybody knows the songs, so they really need to be pitch perfect. And that, and
as you just demonstrated. So thank you
or,
for that.
Or not. they have to be, and they, you have to, you cannot screw up these lyrics. You know, you have to dance. It's a huge dance show. I mean, the dances just don't hold. They don't, you know, they don't pull any punches.
Yeah.
They're like, I mean, you know what I mean. You can't not
and
go crazy.
It seems
with
like
them.
The whole thing about Oklahoma is it's this sort of joyous, you know, all the dances are free flying around, right? And all
yeah,
that kind of stuff, right?
Exactly.
Just seems like that's an enthusiastic.
There's a lot of energy there.
Stuff. Yeah, a lot of energy, right.
Yeah.
So, Christina, what are you doing? Are you playing a role in Oklahoma?
Or
are
I
you
am.
Okay, so what are you doing? What's
I'm
the role?
I'm playing Lori Williams.
Okay, is that the.
She's the lead.
The Shirley
cast. Yes.
Mama Partridge. She was.
Was she?
Oh, yeah.
Way
oh,
later.
Yeah,
way
yeah,
later
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
Definitely
yeah,
way
was.
Later. Oh, I forgot. Yeah,
yeah,
of course she was. Like,
yeah.
Eons later.
Shirley Jones, yeah. She was, you know, David Cassidy's
mom,
actual mom. Yeah. So anyway,
yeah,
sorry.
She's not in
not
the
to
show.
Digress.
She's
but she's the embodiment of
sorry.
Everything beautiful and wonderful about this vision of Oklahoma that's in the play.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty fabulous part. It's the so she's the love interest of a farmhand and a cowboy.
Mm-hmm. You're the cowboy?
And, I'm the cowboy.
All right.
And, yeah, you just got to, if you don't know what already, what
that
happens,
cowboy, he spends a lot of time riding around in the corn, right? Just looking around.
Exactly. There's a
riding
lot of
around
corn
in the corn.
On.
Yeah.
There's a lot of corn
looking
going
at it.
On.
I mean,
it's all about the corn.
It really, it is.
Tell me about the cowboy's character. How do you approach it? Sometimes I think that these characters can seem sort of You know, especially in the movie, sort of, you know, one-dimensional in a way. I am this, and I'm the good guy, I'm the bad guy, I'm the choice she should make, I'm the, you know, that kind of thing. So how do you approach this role?
I'm the good guy.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
all right.
So that was easy. And Oklahoma, Oklahoma is a very straightforward musical. There's nothing really to think about. It's all out there. The music is very lighthearted and, you know, easy and, you know. And I'm madly in love with Lori, and I'm trying to win her, and I think I succeed in that.
What's the conflict for Lori in this, though? What is it?
She has a choice.
She has a choice, but I think it's actually following her heart and knowing what she actually wants inside, regardless of what's the options presented to her.
I see. Okay.
It's a coming-of-age story. Yeah. I mean,
just making decisions, all that kind
of
stuff.
Course,
yeah. Right.
Right. Of course. And knowing how to fall for the right guy as opposed to that wrong guy.
And when to kick into a big number.
Amen.
Right?
Exactly.
You know?
When to dance Amen. About it.
When to dance and when
to
sing.
About it.
Absolutely. Exactly.
How did you guys choose Oklahoma? How did you guys choose, how did Perseverance come about choosing that?
Well, I pitched it to Art, I guess.
Oh, so it's your doing. You wanted this play to do.
Well, he had talked about it years and years ago with another artistic director at Perseverance, and they were like, our space just doesn't lend itself because we can't fly things. You know, we have no fly space, which is, you know, at the top of the theater where you bring in, you know, you fly in people or you fly in scenery. And there's a lot of that in the script.
A lot
in the
of
text
sets,
of this.
A lot of different locations.
Exactly.
And a lot of the movie, I mean, I know the movie, and a lot of
right.
the movie is about these people who are in love with the beauty of where they live and all those.
Right.
They're so tied to that. So,
right.
So how did you approach that?
Well, it's simplifying. So actually, although the characters are characters that we know, it was super important not to make them one-dimensional, you know, because it's telling their story that actually pulls us through. So we've actually pared down a lot of those, you know, flying elements and a lot of the, you know, we don't do curtains and things like that. So it's just a different approach. It's much more simplistic as in the look, but it's certainly not. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's trying to break it down in a way that is accessible so the story really comes alive.
Have you had experience doing a musical where the musical numbers are so well known as Oklahoma?
Yes, I've done a fair amount, like Grease. And,
okay,
you know
right.
what I mean. So,
so
like,
when those happen, what's the audience reaction? Do they start singing along? Do they
totally.
Start, is that what happens?
Totally. Yeah, great. We're gonna get a lot of that here, and people, are, you know, they bounce their head a little bit more because they know what's going
sure,
on.
Sure. Yeah.
They just get a little more excited.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's exciting
yeah.
to hear these songs that we have known all our lives, but just seen maybe in one movie
right.
all of a sudden performed by new people who are super talented and it's
yeah.
right there and it's loud
yeah.
and
yeah
all that
it's,
stuff's you know exciting.
And you know our singers you know Curly and Lori here included are phenomenal, and we have some amazing voices on stage, and that part has been you know it's that goosebumpy thing. I get the goosebump
yeah
thing.
Are there points in this play, just looking at you, Christine, are there points in this play that you, I don't know if you ask actors this question, but I was just going to say, like, are there points in the play that, like, you particularly, like, are a little nervous about? Like, are there featured songs that where there's no cover for you? You know what I mean? Like, for instance, Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, is that a song, is
that's
that one
a,
that?
That's a Curly song.
That's a Curly song? Question. That's for
yeah.
you?
That's,
so
it's both.
This,
you're kind of out there alone, and if you don't carry it, it doesn't carry, right?
That's actually, I prefer that. That's all on me.
So,
right.
Sure.
My biggest concern in terms of the challenge is, of course, the Oklahoma song, which involves the entire cast to sing it. We have to be on top of it, and we have to stay connected in that song in order to make it sound great.
It's a 7-part harmony too.
What?
Yeah.
That doesn't
yeah.
even make sense.
I know, it's insane. I mean, it's a 7-part.
Are there complexities to this that people just like don't even realize that that's what's going on? You know, I mean, what are some of the technical complexities when you talk about, number one, the music, and then secondly, the choreography?
Well, the choreography, you know, you have, I mean, we don't have a proscenium. A proscenium is like a big box theater.
Uh-huh.
And so in this space, it's trying to modify choreography so that it still flies, it still moves, it's still, you know, fun. And it does. It totally does. So that's kind of the big thing. Ricci, Adan has done the choreography, and she's with Juno Dance Unlimited, and they've brought some of their ballerinas in. So we do the ballet, we do the whole thing.
Yeah, it really, I mean, it just seems like such a big undertaking. But once again, just like Christmas Story was such a big undertaking, but such a huge success for Perseverance Theater, I'm just so excited to see this, because it's just great to see how, especially like with given the parameters you guys have. All right, we have a small theater. We have to do so. What are the challenges? That was a fascinating thing to watch of Mice and Men most recently. Just the beautiful set design that lended so much to the success of that play. And I'm just looking so forward to seeing this.
Yeah, I was just gonna add that. That's actually what makes it so beautiful is that you can have these really intimate moments too. In this sort of large, traditionally large-scale musical, that it lends the story like depth and a little more three-dimensional characters, which is exciting for maybe even people who don't like musicals.
You know? Yeah, right. I mean, this is such a tradition that when people think of musicals, this is one of the ones they think of, right? I mean, it's such a defining. Right. What the art form is, Oklahoma is that.
Yeah, it's the first of its kind. It was the first collaboration between Rodgers and Hammerstein, and it's also one of the first musicals that actually took the story, so the book is actually the story in a musical, and it combined the songs, so the songs actually came out of the book. So as opposed to the other way around,
tell me a little bit, and add on to that a little bit more about the history of the play in general, which I don't know about. I've been talking about the movie because that's what I know about.
But yeah,
so
sure.
You're saying there's a book called Oklahoma, and
well,
or is it based on a history?
It's actually based on a play called Green Grow the Lilacs by Lynn Riggs, and Green Grow the Lilacs is set in Oklahoma and Claremore, same space. But then Rodgers and Hammer, and that was written. In the early 1900s. And then Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote this musical in 1941, and they took all the, that book, that script, and then, so in the musical, they actually, you know, where you, all the lyrics and all that stuff is actually the book, mm-hmm. You know. So they put all that together, and it was, you know, 1941, it was the first time, you know, this is wartime, and so people are looking for something sunny.
Yeah. You know? And then did it have an immediate run in Broadway or that kind of thing?
Yeah.
And that was during the 40s?
Yeah, it's the most produced play of musical theater.
But it was a wartime play, actually. So here, as you can imagine, it's everything that people want to think about, what's great and wonderful about America and about the middle America, especially.
Love, warmth, heartland.
Right.
Yeah, connecting to other human beings. It's got all that stuff in there, which I think Juno needs around November, December.
Could always use a little sunshine. That's right. Well, thanks all you guys for coming in. Break a leg, as
thanks.
They say.
I'm
looking forward to seeing it. It's Oklahoma. It's happening opening night, November 9th. Do you want any details on openings and stuff like that you want to tell?
Yeah, sure. So tickets are available at 463-TIXS. You can get them at Hearthside or at the Jack, or you can find it online at perseverancetheater.org. And we run for 5 weekends. So
it's a big run.
It's a big
run. Yeah, great. Yeah. That's terrific.
Yeah, so we want to get, you know, the seats are selling fast, so we want to get everybody in the doors.
So, yeah, get your tickets now. Go online and get them. It's Oklahoma. It's starting November 9th. Thanks again, Perseverance Theater. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
All right.
Every night, my honey lamb and I sit alone and talk and watch a hawk making lazy circles in the sky. We know we belong to the land, and the land we belong to is grand. And when we say, hi-yip-i-o-y-a, we're only saying you're doing fine, Oklahoma, Oklahoma, okay. Watch a hawk making lazy.
Well, the folks in here now aren't going to sing along with me for Oklahoma. Do you want to go, Mandy? You going to do it? No. Oh. Jackie, you
no,
could.
That's all right. Thanks.
Well, I'm sorry to put you guys on the spot like that. That's ridiculous. Well, you guys are here at Alaska State Museum, and a really wonderful thing that's happening, the NOAA Coastal Impressions. Jackie Manning's with me, Julie Spiegel, and Mandy Lindeberg. And, Mandy, you're the artist and or the photographer and a biologist that put this together. So maybe I'll start with you. Tell me a little bit about – holding a book that contains a lot of this work. It's called A Photographic Journey Along Alaska's Gulf Coast. And just tell me a little bit about kind of what it took to put this together. Is this years of work that I'm holding in my hand?
Yeah, I'm a marine biologist with the National Marine Fisheries Service, and we started a coastal habitat mapping project about 10 years ago, very small scale. And
just a kind of small crew going out.
And we're looking at it as a need for a lot of the things our agency needs us to do and be prepared for oil spill response and planning. And along the way, we captured a couple cool photos. So
more than a couple, I'd say. Pages and pages here. So, Jackie, how did the State Museum then get involved with kind of collaborating with NOAA on this and putting together a show?
Well, Mandy came by the museum and she showed us her work, and we fell in love with it. And so we contacted her about doing an exhibit, and we are in the process of hanging them as we speak. And they look beautiful.
I'm holding a magazine kind of size. It's sort of like a National Geographic size magazine with that quality of pictures. So beautiful in a magazine. But what size formats? What's the format size of these photos as you're hanging them?
So I'd say the largest is roughly, I'd say like 20 by 30 in that realm. And then a lot of mid-size around, I'd say 15 by 22 is the mid-range.
Inches,
and then
we're talking about.
Inches,
yeah,
yes.
Awesome if that was in feet, right? I'd love that.
Oh, I wish we had the space for
yes.
it.
Put that in my living room.
Yeah, that's for the expansion.
Yes.
That's later. That's in a couple years.
Next time.
So tell me a little bit more about the hanging and the show that's going to happen.
Well, we keep mentioning as we lay them out the images, of course, hold up beautifully at a large scale, but it's really surprising that all of these images are from Alaska. A lot of them look, I would say, very tropical, almost, just incredible blues and greens, and so we had to verify with Mandy. Yes, this is from Alaska's coastal zone.
That looks like Maui. What are you doing here?
Yeah.
Well, Julie, tell me a little bit about your involvement in this.
Basically, I'm the public affairs officer for NOAA Fisheries, and I have sort of been assisting with getting the exhibit set up and getting the word out to people
this
is going on.
From a public information standpoint, I think it's a great way to just give a little bit of a flavor of all of the things that NOAA does. I mean, people think of NOAA in this fisheries management role, and then here's this example of this is a byproduct of this kind of what we were doing was actually mapping. But here's a byproduct, and hey, we're out there and we're connected to the state you live in.
Right. And it's kind of funny. Mandy was just talking before the show about how when this project started, they didn't envision all these fantastic photos that it would come out to be not just a scientific project, but have an artistic aspect to it.
Yeah, and an educational aspect. I mean, I can imagine. I mean, it's educational just to look at this, just to think about the way things look. Yeah.
And we've also, in our art room, we've set up a whole bunch of art projects based on this exhibit as well.
Cool. So I think the kids who go see this are going to like the creature pictures too, right? Don't you think, Mandy? So tell me about that. It seems like your eye, just as I'm flipping through this, is about landscape and about shape and landscape and that thing. And it might just because you're in airplanes a lot, I would guess. Right?
Well, the key is that we actually map these patterns. And I was on the ground touch and feel biologist and a taxonomist and very good with seaweeds and things. And then they threw me in a helicopter and said, now ID them from 300 feet at 80 miles an hour. So I've gotten pretty good at actually IDing things at that altitude and speed. So the idea is to look at these patterns, and you can actually classify them, and there's very predictable
species associated with these patterns and these bands and these assemblages. So,
the photography you were taking was not just something that was a byproduct of what you're doing, but it was actually pretty key.
It's actually data for us. We have mappers that go in and they get data off these images and put it into a big GIS database, and then we serve that up online. And you can actually go up and go up to shorezone.org and actually get onto the database and fly the coastline yourself and actually look at all the images, look at how we classified the shorelines. We have hundreds of classifications, some from substrate all the way through biology. So it's a very rigorous data set.
Wow, but it's exciting. This is an exciting representation of data. Isn't
yes.
It?
Well,
you know, you often think about data sets. Data sets. Okay.
Yeah,
data sets. Okay. And you know, I think I immediately go to Excel spreadsheets, right? But
yeah.
Here you go. This beautiful exhibit that's happening at the museum, and then this beautiful magazine style booklet. Such a cool way of representing that data.
Exactly. And so the patterns are just striking.
When you say patterns, so you're saying that you see coastal patterns, and then that's going to be indicative of the species that live in that area?
I can see a certain band or certain type of shoreline, and we can actually predict what species we'll find there. If you went there, we'd be pretty accurate.
And so I'm on the page that shows these invertebrates, and so if you tell me about like where you would predict some of these invertebrates living, for instance.
Well, like even just mussels. We're all very familiar with mussels.
Sure.
They can actually form very distinct bands, especially in southeast and fjords. You go up towards Lynn Canal and you'll see this dark black band in the middle of the intertidal. It's all mussels. And we map that. And we can tell you how many kilometers of that there is in Lynn Canal. And so it's a big food resource for scoters. It's a very important resource for other animals, especially in the winter. And so we want to know what is there and map it. But we also in this show you those bands from the air, and then we want to show you close-ups of who is actually making that band. What's the dominant species?
Yeah, really interesting. Is there work that you're specifically doing to try to find not just species but maybe endangered species, or is there stuff there that's involved? Are you doing work specifically like for stellar sea lion work or that kind of thing? Or
Most of it, well, there's so many uses for it. We're interested in it from a forage fish point of view, and herring spawn in the intertidal, and certain species they prefer. We can map those. We can know and predict a good spawning habitat for them. So there's so many different uses and so many different interests. People see the data set and they're like, wow, I need it for this part. I want to go take it for my research. So there's
probably
a wide spectrum.
Unpredicted uses, you know,
exactly.
Things that you wouldn't think of when you're doing this sort of comprehensive data set.
And we do have a ground truthing program. So when we see unique places or get a chance to go down on the ground, we definitely ground truth those areas and see how well we're predicting.
Do you have photography training?
You know, I'm not
experience?
A professional photographer at all. I use a camera totally from a nerd point of view because I need to get data and record that. But I happen to get pretty good with it.
Yeah. And what's the gear you use, or what's the gear you use mostly?
You know, we started out when we first started in 2001 in Cook Inlet with the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council. They funded the very first survey. We were using slide film.
That was back when film.
I know.
I've heard about this thing.
And it took months to get the photos back.
Right, sure. The old days of...
But the digital cameras have improved so much that now we are causing a problem for the online product, because in a four-hour survey, I'll take 5,000 or 6,000 photos, and we'll post all of those. So I'm taking one about every second,
up the gigs
or every 2
there,
seconds.
Yeah.
And we also have upgraded our video to high definition video. So it takes a lot of bandwidth. And the University of Alaska Fairbanks Gina supercomputer is helping serve up a lot of that imagery. So it's really intense with a lot of imagery. But, you know, we're just pushing the technology. And as it gets better and better, we can do way more imagery.
It's just a real concrete way you can see that this increase in technology and broadband connectivity has allowed you to actually have more accurate data and better better information about what's happening on our coastlines.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Jackie, tell me a little bit about the nuts and bolts of the actual opening and all that stuff that's
going
to happen.
Our opening is tomorrow night at 4:30, and it goes from 4:30 until 7, and it is free entry during that time. So we hope you'll make it. And also, Mandy's going to be signing her book, Field Guide to Seaweeds of Alaska, so we'll have a book signing there as well. So.
All sounds very cool. Mandy, thanks so much for coming in. This book here, this booklet of the work is absolutely beautiful. Is this also available for people, or how can people get a hold of this?
That will be available at the museum during the duration of the exhibit.
Great. So. Thanks, Jackie, Julie, and thanks so much, Mandy, as well. It sounds like a really great thing happening at the State Museum starting this first Friday. Coming up next, we're going to hear from Garrison Keillor with Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 1st of November, 2012. Today is All Saints' Day. It was on this day in 1512, Pope Julius II displayed Michelangelo's paintings on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel for the first time, paintings it had taken Michelangelo 4 years to complete, scenes from the Old Testament, including the famous center section, The Creation of Adam. Michelangelo was 33 at the time, and he was not anxious to do this work. He tried to point out to the Pope that he was a sculptor and not really a painter, but the Pope would not listen. And so Michelangelo used his skills as a sculptor to make a two-dimensional ceiling look like a series of three-dimensional scenes. He worked from a scaffold 60 feet above the floor, covering about 10,000 square feet of surface. Every day, fresh plaster was laid over part of the ceiling, and Michelangelo had to finish painting before the plaster dried. It's the birthday of Stephen Crane, born in Newark, New Jersey, 1871. Thought about becoming a professional baseball player as a young man. He played catcher. One of his teammates said he played baseball with fiendish glee. He was spending time in New York City, fascinated by street life there, started writing for tabloids while he was still a teenager, wrote his first novel, Maggie, A Girl of the Streets, which booksellers would not stock. And then, after reading a series of reminiscences of Civil War veterans, Crane decided to write a Civil War novel himself. The result was The Red Badge of Courage, published 1895, the story of a boy named Henry Fleming who signs up for the 304th New York Regiment, hoping to experience the glory of battle that he's read about in school. It made Stephen Crane famous. He was 24 years old. He'd never been in battle himself, and yet Civil War veterans wrote into the newspapers claiming that they'd known Stephen Crane, they'd fought beside him in various battles. He spent the rest of his life working as a war correspondent. On New Year's Eve, 1896, he was on a boat to Cuba to cover the Spanish-American War. The boat sank. Crane survived in a small dinghy with three other men, spent 30 hours at sea, damaged his health, and led to his death a few years later at the age of 28. And it's the birthday of the playwright A.R. Gurney, born in Buffalo, 1930. His first major off-Broadway play was The David Show, opened in 1968. It got rough reviews, but Gurney went on to write more than 40 plays, including scenes from American Life, Love Letters, Sylvia, and most recently, Heresy. Here's a poem for today by Wendell Berry. Whatever is foreseen in joy must be lived out from day to day. Vision held open in the dark by our 10,000 days of work. Harvest will fill the barn. For that the hand must ache, the face must sweat. And yet no leaf or grain is filled by work of ours. The field is tilled and left to grace. That we may reap, great work is done while we're asleep. when we work well, a Sabbath mood rests on our day and finds it good. Lines by Wendell Berry from his long poem, A Timbered Choir, published by Counterpoint and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, you can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vedder, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon here in Juno, where it's mostly cloudy skies for the rest of the day. I saw a little bit of blue skies earlier. That was nice. But increasing clouds predicted for tonight and rain predicted for tomorrow with highs around 41 degrees. Rain likely for Friday night and into the weekend and through Monday. Oh, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but there you go. It's going to rain this weekend is what Noah's telling us. And we've got now in the studio with us Catherine Mendoza. Thanks so much for coming in. Also, with us is Maria Yucatel and Sarah Lynn Tabachnik, all involved with the fundraiser coming up for the Aware Shelter. Sarah Lynn, I'll turn to you first and just tell us a little bit about this really interesting capital campaign, what that money is going towards, and just sort of a little bit about the need there that you're looking to fulfill.
Great, thanks. You know, we've got this great emergency shelter where we're able to provide safe shelter for women and families who need emergency safe shelter. What is lacking is a second step where women and families can go for the same safety and security after they leave emergency safe shelter. So we're looking to build transitional housing, extended stay, where women and families could stay for 3 to 18 months or so. We've been in a process of raising funds, and we recently were awarded by the Erasmussen Foundation funds, actually $850,000 outright and $150,000 in dollar-for-dollar match when this community raises $150,000, which is beautiful because, as you know, we've got a great community.
Yeah, and it also makes the community tie into that facility so that people become aware of it and people have a real vested interest in making sure the whole enterprise is successful.
Right.
I think that's a great way of looking at it. And Catherine Mendoza, you are the owner of Alpaca International Wool. And thanks so much for coming in. And you have a really cool thing, which is that you're going to kind of kick this off with a fundraiser this weekend.
Yes, just to make a correction, I am the new manager.
Sorry.
Store manager.
Okay.
Zia Picaccio is the owner.
Yes, and I've met Zia. I know Zia. Yes.
This is her fifth store.
Okay.
Well, Maria approached us about this fundraiser, and Zia was more than happy to commit to it. And so this weekend we are having our grand reopening, and so tomorrow we will have local artists. A few of the ladies are from Aware, and that's Mandy Johnson, who is an administrative assistant, and Christine Lowry, who is a Children's AmeriCorps advocate. And so we'll be showing their work. Along with that, 10% of sales for Friday will go to Aware to help them reach their goal. And then Saturday, we will have another event, and that'll be our bigger event. And 15% of sales will be going to Aware.
So a great opportunity to get some Christmas shopping done. It's getting cold out. The snow is on the ground. Get some good alpaca.
Yes, I am products. I'm wearing
beautiful
a jacket
sweater.
Right now. Yes,
it's jacket there. Yes,
very pretty. And Maria here is wearing a beautiful sweater. It's alpaca.
Well, Maria, tell me, as you just said, Catherine, you approached Alpaca about doing this. What was the connection there, and why did you think that was a good fit?
Well, I'm a volunteer at Aware, and I go there regularly. Whatever happens, I mostly work with kids, but I do a lot of kitchen work, cooking. And I'm very committed to Aware. I'm also a donor. I donated some funds for the capital campaign. Mm-hmm. And Zia is a friend of mine, and she was thinking how to come back to the community, open for the winter, you know, commitment to the community and offering options for shopping. And she says, well, you know, what do you think? And I said, yeah, great. Come on, I'm open for the winter, but also, you know, to have more commitment to the community, donate some funding to AWARE. And she thought it was a great idea.
Yeah, well, it is a great idea. Yeah.
So working hard with Kathy and with Sarah Lynn to open this weekend. I think First Friday would be a great time, and the weekend, and have some options, and come on down, like you said, Christmas shopping.
Yeah. Do you, Sarah Lynn was just expressing the need for this extended stay. Is that something that you have seen a need for in working at the AWARE shelter and just volunteering and seeing the people that come through there?
Yeah, I think so. I think sometimes we see some people come back, and I think if they had time to go transitional housing, that would better adjust. So I'm thinking that that would be a great addition to our community and stabilizing families. So I'm looking forward to the shelter, to the transitional housing.
Sarah Lynn, when a person comes through the AWARE shelter, and what's the typical process whereby they, you know, the leave has to end? Does it have to end a little bit earlier than sometimes? Or tell me a little bit about this need for transitional housing. I think I kind of understand it, but
yeah,
as a
really
professional, tell me, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great question, because part of the problem in Juneau is there's a lack of affordable housing. So even if you or I were trying to look for housing, it would be difficult.
Yeah.
So if you can imagine then someone who has lived with violence in their lives and that trauma, and they're trying to create safety and stability for their families, then to try to find housing on top of that that's affordable is an extra challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we work with women to try to find housing, and it's really difficult. Often when people leave AWARE, they go to stay with family or friends. It's not so often that they really get long-term housing, and we want to make that a process that's much more easy to accomplish.
It sort of happens that sometimes if they leave and they kind of sort of fall back in with some of the same issues that maybe were a problem before they got into the shelter. Is that kind of
that could well happen? Yeah.
So it's just adding to the safety and well-being of these people that are trying to adjust to a difficult situation already in their life.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it sounds like a great project. It's exciting to hear that Rasmussen has awarded some funds, and that also is going to be involving the community in this matching program, which I think is going to be successful,
yeah,
of course.
You know, if I can also say, we've gotten money from the state of Alaska. We're working with the city, who applied for CDBG funding on our behalf that was awarded, and we've got our campaign chairs, Marla Berg and First Lady Sandy Parnell, and, you know, it's kind of a dream team.
Yeah, great, and a lot of it is, if you're interested in this and finding out more about it and want to make a contribution and want to just have some fun, go to Alpaca International tomorrow for First Friday, the First Friday celebration there.
Yes, and we'll be open from 5:30 to 8:30, and then Saturday from noon to 6.
Great, and Saturday, 15% of all the sales will go to this new campaign for the AWARE shelter that's being built. Well, Catherine, Maria, and Sarah Lynn, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you. Well, welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Joining me now is Elise Tomlinson and Pao Manu, who are here to talk about First Friday at the Franklin Street Gallery. And Elise, some of your work will be there. And Pao, you're the gallery manager, and we'll be showing this work. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about why, Elise. Why did you choose this talented artist of all the talented artists out there?
Well, I really love Elise's work. And
yeah, tell me what it is that draws you to her work, and what
it's a combination of the figurative and the natural environment, and the way that she puts together lines and color are very smooth, and they work to me. They're very feminine paintings.
Oh, that's an interesting.
And I just love them. I mean, I love her figures and the landscape. Nice. But you may have different things for this show.
That was my next question, Elise. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask, for this show, concentrate on creating a bunch of new work that you wanted to do for it, or is it a kind of a retrospective of a lot of different periods of your work?
It started out just going to be some new paintings, but that space is actually quite large.
Okay.
We scoped it out, and it's like, wow, that's a lot of wall. So retroactively decided, why not show some older work as well? And then when I started looking through, I usually only ever exhibit work one time, and then I kind of put it in storage, and maybe it sells online, but probably not. And so pulling things out was really fun from the last 13 years that I've been exhibiting in Juneau, and kind of seeing how my style's changed over time. And I sort of started repainting some of the older work, which was a little weird because I don't paint the same way anymore. So I'm like, oh, I kind of feel it was fun, but it was also, you get used to a painting looking a certain way, and then some of them I kind of completely repainted.
You mean you painted over them?
Well, it's the same essential painting,
right?
But like, hey, what would she look like with purple hair? Or, you know, what if I made this tree green?
You couldn't leave it alone.
No, I just couldn't leave it alone.
That is fascinating to me. First of all, you did describe it just now, but tell me a little bit more about the process for an artist to go back and see. I mean, in some ways, I'll bet it was, and sometimes it was painful, right? And sometimes it was exciting.
Sometimes I ruined them. There are paintings that are gone forever, probably, because I, and I was talking to Pua about this when we were in the hall about.
Pua is also a very talented
amazing
artist.
Amazing.
So
I just bought
also,
one of her paintings at the last show in that space.
Right.
She's phenomenal. But I was just talking about how I was looking at these paintings, and right before a show, you start to get very conservative because you can ruin a painting in the course of a few minutes. One false stroke, and then you have to kind of work against that, and it can go out of control
very fast. I can't imagine the pressure on an artist to. Yeah, I mean, that must be intense.
So there have been pieces and shows in the past that I was never like 100% happy with, but I didn't have the courage to sort of go there and fix it and change it right before the opening. So I pulled some of those out, and I thought, hey, I have really nothing to lose now. I can try it, and if I ruin it, nothing lost. I mean, it's already been exhibited, and I can just put it back in storage. So so it was great to have that freedom to just go in and kind of go crazy and try some different things. And most of the changes I made were pretty modest, but,
When looking at your old paintings, did you remember a technique or a style that you thought, oh, I need to reawaken that that kind
absolutely.
Of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I noticed that I used to use a lot more paint, like a lot more texture. I've really gotten into more smooth applications of the paint. And I think it's because I use a much more expensive paint now than I used to. So it's like, I can't really afford to gob it on there.
I love it. That's a good little admittance
when
there.
When you pay $25 for a teeny tiny tube of paint, you really kind of have to rethink how you're going to do that.
That's interesting.
So, and then things like the way that I used to hand build all my canvases, and that just became so labor intensive that I started buying them. So, but when you hand wrap them, you don't maybe frame them because they're gallery wrapped and the sides are painted. So I noticed things like that, and just I noticed that I didn't use very much detail. Like some of the hands in my older work just look like moths. You know, they were like kind of just little circles with maybe some squiggles.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're very, you know, all the veins and everything I paint. So they each have their own sort of thing that I like about them. I liked being more stylized and looser and more gestural, and now it's kind of more representational maybe, but I like them both. So
has that been conscious decisions and conscious changes in most cases, or has it just been just the kind of natural evolution of what you've been doing as an artist?
I think it's been more of a natural evolution. Yeah. I don't remember ever time saying, gee, I'm going to paint
more veins in that hand.
More
yeah.
veins. That's what it's lacking.
Right.
You know, I don't think I ever went there, but there's still a lot of outlining. That's the one thing that has never changed, and I don't know why, but I can't exhibit or even stop painting a work until it's outlined, every single thing. I mean, if it's a fireweed flower, for uh-huh. example, outlining every single flower and every single leaf and everything, I mean, it's very, very time consuming.
Even
but
though
it's,
you have this, you have the ability to just paint that flower, right?
Right.
Could just do that. But.
I do, but then after I paint it, I have to outline it. Sometimes I have to outline it like 10 times.
Oh, interesting.
Because if you repaint the petals of the flower, for example, it could then the paint can go off onto the outlining, and then you need to re-outline it.
Oh, I see.
So over and over and over again, it's very time consuming to paint with outlining. But I just, for whatever reason, that's what makes it feel finished to me. Maybe because I read a lot of comics growing up. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
but I'm sure it's what people, even without knowing that that's the technique, it might be a lot of what people associate with the style that they love in your paintings. You know, that look is definitely something that defines what your paintings look like. Must or not. I don't know.
I hope so.
Yeah,
I know.
Right.
I know that sometimes when I in the past have exhibited with other artists, when I see work that's very realistic, and even though I paint more realistic, it's still not realistic, like realistic. It's just more realistic mm-hmm. than what I used to do.
Mm-hmm.
It can look very flat. My paintings can look very flat and just depending on what you're looking at it compared to, if there's something else on the wall next to it, it can sort of diminish in my eyes what the work looks like because of I'm not trying to be fully three-dimensional. I'm going for a specific look, and not everybody likes that.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that because I'm really only trying to do what I like.
Yeah, you're not an artist to paint what everybody likes. You're an artist to
express yourself. So it's an acquired taste.
Yeah, right. Well, Pau, tell me some of the details of if people want to go to this and where all the gallery is and all that stuff.
Okay, the Franklin Street Gallery is at the Baranoff Hotel up on Franklin Street. It's Franklin and 2nd, and the opening starts, or the exhibition opens tomorrow. It starts at 4:30, and it goes to 6:30 or 7.
Is there also a wine tasting associated with this?
There is going to be wine tasting associated with it.
I mean, not to say
it.
That's why I go to the Franklin Street Gallery.
It's actually the best, if you drink wine, it's the best deal for a glass of wine because you get to sample all different kinds of wines, and there are three different distributors in town.
And you're filling all the walls? It's a one-person show filling all the walls?
Show,
that
yes.
is a lot of wall space.
I think I just did the title cards, and I think I had 28
nice.
Pieces.
Well, that's going to be really exceptionally fun to just go and see not only all your new work, but then, as you say, some of the evolution of how you got to where you're painting now and the people who
the
love
lines.
Your work and the lines, the lines, the
people
outlines.
People will be looking at the lines.
Well, when
the
I go, veins. I'm going to sound really intelligent tomorrow because I'm going to walk around going, well, if you notice the outlines on this one, it'll be great. So thanks for that
Wonderful.
Tip.
It'll be up for the entire month of November through the very first Tuesday in December, Tuesday or Wednesday in December.
Great. Well, that's going to be for starting first Friday. It's at the Franklin Street Gallery. It's Elise Tomlinson, some retrospective, and then also a lot of new works. And then that's happening at the Franklin Street Gallery. So Pau Manu and Elise Tomlinson, thanks so much for coming in and letting
thank
us
you,
know what's
Mandy.
Happening there. All right.
Thank you, and good luck with Pledge Drive.
Yes. Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Everybody donate.
Back with the Juno Afternoon, Nancy DeCherney from the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. Now for Arts Up!
Hey!
Remember that title? Arts Up!
Yes.
What's going on? Let's just get right into
okay,
it.
Okay, first Friday, you've just been talking about that. That's tomorrow. Tonight, we have Macbeth. Of course, you got Macbeth through the weekend. Okay, we'll just hit the high points, and then we'll go back and fill in the blanks.
That sounds good.
Okay. Sunday, it is Daylight Savings Time ends. This is key.
Thank you.
And Tuesday is Election Day.
Well, yes. Okay.
All right. So
that's
now
like
we'll fill
everything
in the
up. Not just art. That's the whole shamil.
That's the whole thing. Okay. So First Friday, in addition to all of the gallery openings, and I encourage you to come by and get your little flyer so you know where to go because there's a bunch of them. There's a wine tasting at 5:30 on silent auction to benefit Five Finger Lighthouse. That's at the Hangar Ballroom. You get the tickets for that at the door. Hairspray.
Hairspray, I know. Woo-hoo! It's going to be fun.
It's going to be great. Friday nights is at 6:30. Then Saturday, it's at 7. It runs for 2 weekends, but again, you can
get the tickets now. Go early because you're going to get to the last weekend and you're going to say, oh,
I missed
darn
that.
It.
Yeah, so that's that. And then we do, of course, have Macbeth running through. We have a Halloween fund rave. Over at the Jack, it's at 9 p.m., and this is for ages 16 and above. It is a benefit for a young woman who's facing some medical problems, and so that's a you get the tickets at Choco for $10 or at the door.
Okay.
It's we have the Christmas bazaars, holiday bazaars are starting. The first one is over at the Douglas Community Methodist Church on Saturday at 9 a.m., at the City Museum or the State Museum, they're doing some really cool stuff. Nature and Nurture, Drawing Animals, Drawing from Nature. At 10 a.m., it's for grades K through 2, and at 1 p.m., it's for grades 3 through 5. This is with the woman who's opening her exhibit at the museum, Kristen Link. So it's offered by the Friends of the State Museum, and it's free. It's also at 10 a.m., the 60th annual ski swap.
60? 60. It's the 60th time they've held a ski swap?
That's what they say.
That's crazy talk.
We weren't
even a state back then, I don't think. Were we? Barely.
We were barely. No, it was 66. Yeah, okay.
We're barely a state.
Yeah.
All right.
But anyway, you can go get some old skis.
Yes, you can get old skis there. Go get old skis.
And across the parking lot simultaneously will be a mosquito market. There will be no ski swap things. They're just, it's kind of a garage sale. So come on over.
Like a flea market, but for Southeast mosquito market. Yes,
yes.
That's a fun thing that's happening at the Jack.
It seems like it. People are really enjoying it.
Writing
in the Rain, also at 10 o'clock, a 49 Writers Workshop. This will be at the Canvas, which is on 223 Seward Street. There all weekend, Nugget Malls have an arts, crafts, and antiques. There is the 11th annual Special Olympics Spaghetti Feed out at Thunder Mountain High School at 4:30. You can just get tickets at the door, 7 o'clock, Hairspray. There's the Fall Concert Series for the Juno Student Symphony. This is at 7:30 at the Jack, and again on Sunday at 4. At the 7:30, also the Gold Street Music Concert Series begins, and they're going to have Hillbilly Honeys, the Wrist Rockets, Kari Griffin is singing with Tom Loker. I don't know what all.
I'll tell you, that music series is really a fun deal.
I've been
to that a number of times. It's always great. It's a very cool, intimate setting. You really get to hear the music. It's really a fun thing to go to.
Takes place at the Resurrection Lutheran Church, which is on West 10th Street. As I mentioned, Fallback on Sunday, so you can stay out late. I always like that.
All right. Yes. Wait a minute. I perked up on that one. Okay.
On Sunday at 7:30, it is the Oklahoma First Pay-As-You-Can preview.
We just talked to Perseverance Theater here, and they even sang Oklahoma live in the studio for us.
Oh, my gosh.
It was really fun.
The music from Oklahoma,
yes.
I totally love it. And then, so as I mentioned, you got a vote on Tuesday. At noon, Rosita Worrell is doing the brown bag lunch lecture series down at the Sea Alaska Plaza in the fourth floor boardroom. You're encouraged to come down. She's talking about art and artifacts. There is a papermaking class. Let's see. 7 p.m. on Wednesday, it is the Wildlife Wednesday out at the U.S. Glacier View Room. It's Alaska Student Ocean Discoveries, Technology, Coastal Schools, and Traditional Knowledge Drive Marine Science Camp Success. I would like to say
sounds sciencey.
It's too long of a name.
It's too long. It's not the catchiest name, but... sciencey.
It's very sciencey.
It'll bring in the geeks.
Okay. Didn't we have something for adult geeks the other day?
Yeah,
I don't know. Anyway, so it is, and again, Oklahoma has a preview, a pay-as-you-can preview on Wednesday at 7:30. So that's some of the highlights. Let's see.
See, we got through it.
We
don't have to be done right this second, but
okay.
We got through it.
All right.
Get anything else you want to cover on the way?
Well, you know.
Well, for First Friday, what are some of your highlights for First Friday?
Well, of course, we've got Christiane Carrillo over at our our place.
Seeing red, yes.
There's all these red strings all over the place. It's really cool. And there'll be a little preview of the symphony because they'll be performing there, rehearsing. Let's see, Bee's Bistro Bakery and Bistro is celebrating their first anniversary.
Yes.
So that'll be fun. She's doing edible art. So we understand you can eat most of what she's got there.
That sounds fun. Just pick it right off the walls.
The brewery has got the downtown at the depot. They're doing Oh My Gourd Pumpkin Porter Ale. And they'll be having that. And then the Acoustadelic Rock Group DNR will be performing down there. There's a couple of new places. Aurora Healing Arts is starting. This is Alaska Botanicals. They're on South Franklin Street. Let's see, what is some of the, were you just talking to Elise? Yes, you were.
I was.
Okay, Heritage Coffee, you need to go to the Heritage Coffee, 2nd Street. They're the Alaska Lithos Photographs of Motion Public Voting.
Okay, you're being played off with, what a beautiful morning right now.
Okay, then.
That's it for a Juno afternoon. Thanks, Nancy.
See ya. I got a beautiful feeling.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. Along the devastated New Jersey...